One of the most famous allegories ever is an allegory called the Allegory of the Cave. And it was the allegory of the cave comes from the Greek philosopher Plato, who lived roughly about 400 years before Christ. And this allegory of the cave, it's an allegory for how Plato, the philosopher, how he believed, it was like a description of reality for him. And so the allegory of the cave, it goes like this, that this is how life is like. Life is as if you have grown up in a cave all of your life. And if you can imagine growing up in a cave and being chained in that cave, only being able to look at the blank wall of that cave in front of you. Now behind you, as you've grown up in this cave, only being able to look at this blank wall, behind you, there's an opening and the sun shines through that opening. But you don't know what the sun looks like because you've never been able to turn around and see the sun. You don't know what's going on in that world behind you, all the green grass and all the fields, all the trees, all the animals, because you're never able to turn around and see them. All you can see is what's on that blank wall. Now, what that sun will do and that sunlight will do is it will create shadows from the things that you can't see. It'll create shadows on the wall in front of you. And you can see and begin to discern how there are different shadows. You can give names to those different shadows. But ultimately, the job and the goal in life for Plato was to become unchained from that cave and to be able to go out into the real world and see the substance of what things really are. Because this whole time, what you've been viewing as you grow up, as you perceive the world around you, you've just been perceiving the shadows. You look at life's like this as well. That what we do is we live and we walk and we have our being is the things that we come in contact with. There are only shadows or the shadowy part of the true substance. They're the shadows of a transcendent reality or a heavenly reality. And he thought that all things pointed to something greater in some type of way. Now he's speaking 400 years before Christ, so he didn't get every single thing right, but it's a phenomenal analogy. And unfortunately for Plato, he lived 400 years before Christ, so he wouldn't live to see the day in the flesh of Jesus Christ coming down, the real transcendent, the real heavenly reality, coming down and walking among men. But his analogy, it holds true, at least in some ways, because here in Ephesians chapter 5, as we're talking about marriage, this is what Paul says that marriage is, that marriage, it's as wonderful as it is between the union between a man and a woman in marriage, it's actually pointing to something greater. It's pointing to a profound mystery of Christ's love and sacrifice for the church and the church's devotion and following of Christ. This section in Ephesians chapter 5, as we talk about the mystery of marriage today, this section in Ephesians chapter 5, that begins roughly in around verse 21 and goes all the way until chapter 6, verse 9. Paul's not just going to talk about marriage. He's going to talk about the relationship between children and their parents. He's going to talk about the relationship between slaves and their masters. And these writings, a lot of times they're referred to, there's a section in Colossians that is like this as well. It's referred to as the household code or the household codes of Ephesians. You think of a household and there are certain codes that a household should live by. And it gets that name because household codes, it's not just something that shows up in the New Testament. In the Roman world, there were a lot of household codes. There were other philosophers and other teachers that had writings on how houses were supposed to act and how the relationships were supposed to be conducted. The Romans were especially fervent about making sure that there were household codes that everybody was aware of, because the Romans were, at the time, in Paul's time, they were really scared of a lot of these religions coming in from the east and swamping the Roman Empire, and they were scared that they were going to destabilize the family and then destabilize the empire. And so they made sure that their philosophers and teachers that were teaching about how should households behave. But the household codes of the Roman Empire, it's kind of funny. They weren't addressed to wives. They weren't addressed to slaves. They weren't addressed to children. They were only addressed to the man of the household, to the husband or to the father. Because in the Roman Empire view, it's not just that the husband was the head of the house, but the husband was like the emperor of the house. The husband was the king, the monarch over the household. Aristotle, who was a philosopher that was a protege of Plato and came after Plato. Aristotle, when he talks about the household, he talks about fathers being kind of like the king over their colony. The father and the husband is the king over the wife and the king over his kids. And the Romans saw it this way as well, that families were just kind of like the Roman Empire in miniature. The emperor had absolute say in every single thing and an absolute right to dominate. And so did man in the household as well. And so what Paul instructs families, not just husbands and wives, but as he talks to kids and their parents, and as he talks to slaves and their masters, it's actually dropping a bombshell that we don't always catch in our modern day. Because what he does, he doesn't just address the male. He addresses the wife as well. He doesn't just address the parent. He addresses the child also. He doesn't address just the master. He addresses the slave as well. Because Paul really meant what he said back in Galatians 3:28 when he said that there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ. In other words, Paul recognizes there's different roles that we play out in the lives that we live, but they're different roles. They're not better roles. They're not better or worse roles. And what he wants the Ephesians to recognize is that where you are in your place and what you're doing, you have a choice in how you act. It's not just up to the husband, and it's not the husband's right to force submission on the part of anybody that's in his household. But Paul addresses everybody as equals. And in the marriage relationship, he addresses the male and the female as equals that he's talking to, and both have their roles and both have their equal choice in acting in fulfillment of Christ. And so today we're going to talk about marriage, and we're going to talk about the mystery of marriage. We're going to begin talking about with wives, the dignity of submission. And we'll talk about husbands and the duty of love. And all of this also points back to the real mystery of marriage, that marriages, at their best, what they are is a reflection of Christ's love for the church here on earth. So let's go back to Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. I want to mention a funny thing before I began. I told Beth this. I didn't even realize it until I got here. I'm preaching a marriage sermon, and I left my wedding ring at home. Last night, I took it off because my finger was just getting fat, and then I didn't put it back on. But this is still going to be a fine, good sermon. So Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. Ephesians 5, verse 22. Let's talk about the duty, or let's talk about the dignity of submission. 5:22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. So Paul begins talking to wives, and he instructs them on submitting to the husband as the head of the marriage. Now, this is a thing that we better not miss at all. The submission is not just a thing that wives do. It's a thing that Christians do. So let's talk about that on the front side, the dignity of submission. Submission is not just something that wives do. Submission is something that Christians do. Read back just in chapter 5, verse 21, right before he gets to wives, he says, he's talking to everybody. He says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. This is how Christians just in the church should be acting. They should be submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And actually goes a little bit deeper than that. Our translations, our English translations, they have that word submit in verse 21. They have that word submit in verse 22. In the Greek, it only has the word submit one time. Verse 21, it says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, and wives to your husbands. That word submit, it just is assumed, it just carries over. But the point is that there's a connection between those. He's saying these things one after the other. And if the only time, and so he's not just talking about wives submitting, he's talking about also that Christians, it's something that Christians do as well. They submit to one another. Christians, we know this from Romans 13, they submit to their government. They're subject to their government. Christians, we're in Philippians chapter 2, Paul talks about have this mind in you that Christ had. Where Christ, he was submissive to the Father. And he was also submissive to his oppressors and obedient to the point of death. And Paul says, have this like mind in you. In other words, if the only time that we ever talk about submission is just in the context of wives or women, well, we're actually doing it pretty wrong. We're kind of messing that up. And all of it's saying that with wives, when it comes to wives, it's saying this is how within the household, the wives are also practicing submission. It's how they're practicing Christ-like within the marriage relationship as well. But it's something that Christians should be doing in their regular lives as well to one another. When it comes to submission, it's not Submission is not a question of value either. Submission is, and one who is submissive is not questioning their value any more than when Christians submit to one another's, chapter 5, verse 21 says, it doesn't mean that one Christian is more valuable than the other. When Christians submit to their government, it doesn't mean that Christians are less valuable in God's eyes than the government that's created by the people for the people, at least here. When Christ submitted to the Father, it would be blasphemous to say that Christ was less valuable or anything less than the Father. And it would be even more blasphemous to say that Christ was less or less valuable than the oppressors that he was obedient to the point of death. So submission doesn't have to do with a question of value. What submission has to do with is it has to do with roles and maintaining proper order. And so this is something that Paul recognizes, something that within the world he lived in, we kind of recognize it in our world. We've just tried to flatten out every single role, and we think roles are bad. But we actually recognize that just within any type of organization where there's more than one person, that conflicts arise. And there has to be some type of roles between different people in order for things to function. And marriage itself, it's a relationship. It's not just some cold-hearted organization, and it better not be some type of cold-hearted organization. And in a relationship, not always in organizations, but in a relationship, there always has to be communication. This is the basis of any type of relationship, that people communicate with each other and talk with one another. And if the husband believes that because I'm head, I don't have to do that, I don't have to ask what my wife's needs are or have to think about it because I can just do what I want to do, well, then it's a failure. That's a huge failure on the husband's part. But in a relationship, back to that, in a relationship, there's always communication. In communication, if you communicate with people, there's always disagreement as well. Maybe not always, but there's going to be disagreements in relationships and in communication. And just because there's disagreements when there's communication between people, that doesn't mean that non-submission is going on. That's actually when we ultimately practice submitting our wills to others in the context of a relationship, in the context of a conversation and talking and communication, in the context of disagreement. That's where we actually practice submitting our wills to others. Because when we're in a relationship and there's communication and there's disagreement, we really have two choices. We can either say, you know what? This relationship is just not worth it. You go your way and I'll go my way. We can both have our ways, and the relationship is the thing that we're just going to kick to the curb. It's always the option. It's always an option. But the option that Paul's asking to happen, and this is the option that also within the church when we have disagreements, this is played out as well. Within the marriage relationship, what Paul's getting at is the way that submission plays is that when there is communication, when husbands and wives are talking to each other and on an issue, there's not an agreement on there, that wives should trust their husband's judgment and should submit to their husband's judgment in that matter. This doesn't mean that the wife's judgment is never followed through. Because in a proper marriage relationship, and we're going to get into this more as we get to husbands, the husband who is sacrificing his own needs for his wife, or the husband who is putting his wife's needs above his own, hopefully the husband should, a lot of the time, maybe even most of the time, be following what might be in many cases the judgment of his wife in certain matters, especially in matters where he has no idea about. There should be the husband himself following his wife's advice. But at the end of the day, what it comes down to is that the husbands are the ones that are going to bear the weight of the decisions that they make, whether it was the wife's judgment they followed or whether it was their own judgment that the wife submitted to. It's the husband that's going to bear the weight of his decisions, and it's him at the end of the day that's going to bear the responsibility for that. There's a dignity in submission as well, and we see even in the Bible there's examples of submission between two parties that are not unequal. If you remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, this is what Christ does. Christ, within the context of a relationship with the Father and communicating to the Father, You saw that what Jesus was hoping would happen and what he knew that the Father was asking of him, they weren't completely parallel at the time. He asked the Father, look, if anything can be done, if this cup can be passed from me, please, but not my will, but thine be done. And it shows us an example of what submission is, that it doesn't mean that it's the course that we like the best or that's the most helpful to us, but it's followed through in Christ with a trust in the Father and a trust in the Father's will. Here in Ephesians chapter 5, as we talk about the dignity of submission, I want to make that clear, if I haven't already, that there is dignity in what Paul's asking. Submission is something that Christ does. Submission is something that Christians should do. And there's a dignity in the way that Paul is addressing. He's addressing the women. He's addressing the wives. In other words, what Paul's saying is, you know what? You're going to hear what I have to say here, but you don't have to follow it. Now, you might not be pleasing to God if you don't follow through with this, but you have a choice in the matter. It's not a given that you're going to submit. It's not a given that you're going to follow the lead of your husband. You have a choice in how you act in this type of regard, which is a very big thing, especially in the Roman world, that Paul would write to wives in the same way that he's going to write to husbands, that they have a choice in the matter, that they have dignity, that they have free will to choose or to go the opposite way. This is big in the Roman world, again, these household codes, when they would write them, it was always addressed to the father or the husband. He was told how his wife's supposed to act, and it's up to the husband to make sure and enforce that she follows him. That he, if he wants to take mistresses, he can, and the wife better not really talk about that one way or the other. Wives and women within the ancient world, they were treated as spoils of war. If you went into a neighboring country and took them over, well, the females there were considered property that you could take for your own gain. It was part of the payment system, part of the motivation for soldiers. And it's in this world that Paul's saying that you're not chattel, you're not weak, and you have a choice. You have a choice that you could go the other way on as well, but if you're pleasing to God, you follow Paul's advice. Then Paul moves on from the dignity of submission to talk about husbands. And with husbands, he talks about the duty of love. So let's talk about Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25. He says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. I'm going to make a quick point, as we move into the duty of love. Let me make a quick point about leadership and husbands with it. Because back in verse 23, as he's instructing wives, he says the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Leaders bear greater responsibility for failure. This is always the case, whether it's the manager of a baseball team, the coach of a football team, whether it's the CEO, leaders always bear a greater responsibility for the failure. And if husbands aren't willing to live with that, then maybe you just shouldn't be a husband. Maybe that's just not the role for you. When we look into the world as well, we recognize that marriage is just not a hallowed place within the world. It's just not a respected place. I was looking back at statistics, and you've heard things like this before. It was back in the 1980s roughly it was expected that half of marriages, 50% of marriages, would end in divorce. That number has actually gone down now in 2022. Over the last few years, it's now roughly expected that about 40% of marriages will end in divorce or separation. So still not good. It's a little bit lower, but that's not really good news, because in the meantime, what's really happened is people just aren't getting married. people are cohabiting. And marriage is just, it's just not seen as really the place to show intimacy anymore. It's not seen as the place to raise a family anymore. And so within this context of marriage just not having a very high place within society, it's not any surprise that marriage has undergone the redefinition of what marriage is. Where even I don't know exactly when this change happened, but it's roughly in the last 10 years that, I mean, the Oxford Dictionary has changed literally changed the definition of what marriage has historically meant to include not just men and women, but within the same sex as well. And so it's no surprise that all of this happens within a context where marriage is just not really been respected in any way. And that goes back to husbands. Now in a marriage, it takes two to make a marriage. And I'm not saying that in every type of marriage failure that it's only and always the husband's fault. But leaders always take a bigger brunt of the responsibility and a bigger share of the failure when things happen. I was reminded of this about 10 or so years ago. I remember it was when Whitney Houston died. And I remember when Whitney Houston died, and there were a lot of reports about her and the issues she had and the difficulties she had, and also her marriage, and the marriage, which was a very tumultuous marriage, and a marriage in which there was a lot of abuse from her husband, a lot of reported abuse. And I remember hearing that at the time and having just a little bit of an epiphany, and also realizing, first of all, this isn't the first time I've heard this story, which is a little bit disgusting. This isn't the first time that I've heard this story of especially famous figures of a husband just abusing or treating his wife horribly. And it made me realize, well, no wonder we live in a day and age where Ephesians 5 verse 22 through 24, wives submitting to your husband. No wonder that's anathema to us in the world, because when we look at the world and we see when we see what marriage looks like in the world, and we see husbands who have mistreated and hurt and not loved their wife in one bit, well, no wonder that submission is such a hard thing to even talk about, because husbands have not been playing out their part in how they should be treating their wives. And if I were a wife, if I was a female, I wouldn't want to be in a marriage where I'm being asked to submit to a husband that was hurting me in some type of way. And this is a depiction that we see. And unfortunately, we even know people, and even in our personal lives, it's not just in the media or a famous thing. We all have known people in our lives where we have seen marriages like this. No wonder the part instructed to the wives seems so difficult and hard when husbands haven't kept up their end of the bargain. Leaders always bear a bigger share of the responsibility, and we should ultimately own that this is part of the reason why marriages is such in a bad place, because husbands haven't been doing their duty of love. And so we've talked about leadership, but this is the funny thing. This is the funny thing when we get to Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25 onward, when Paul moves from the wife and he talks about the husband. He doesn't mention the word leadership once. He doesn't tell husbands to lead. He doesn't tell husbands to exert authority over the wife. He doesn't talk about the husbands being the head of the house when he talks to husbands. That's not the word that comes up at all. Over and over again. Actually, when I read back this, and I read back through it several times, this surprised me when I realized this for the first time. I want you to read it with me again. The word that keeps coming up is love. Not a synonym for leadership, not a synonym for headship, it's love. Ephesians 5, 25, just read that with me again so you know that I'm not pulling something over on you. Ephesians 5, 25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. So over and over again, Paul doesn't instruct husbands to lead their wives. He instructs them to love their wives. And I think part of the reason this is the case is you think about within our society, you think about men. This is just a thing that men have ingrained in them. They feel the need to lead. We have this idea of the alpha male, and the alpha male is the one that not only wants to lead his household, but he wants to lead the business. He wants to lead other men as well. Men know a little bit about leadership. It's almost as if it's ingrained into us to be leaders. And Paul's saying, you know what? You know a little bit about that, but let me tell you what you need within a marriage. You need love. And before you start talking about leadership, let's talk about love. Now, the husband is the head of the household. He says this to wives, but he doesn't say this to husbands. He tells it to wives, but it's not the husband's job to say to his wife, I'm the leader, you submit to me. It's the wife who chooses to do that, and it's the husband that leads through his love. And he compares the husband to Christ over and over and over. Now, Christ, we know, is the head of the church. Christ is the leader over the church. But I want you to think about that as well, what that means for Christ being the leader and the head over the church. None of us became Christians because Christ forced us to do it. None of us became Christians at gunpoint. The way that Christ led was exactly as Paul said that he led. He led by giving his body, by sacrificing himself, dying for us, and dying for us when we were completely unworthy of it, and dying for us in loving us so that we would have a reason to follow him. In other words, Jesus Christ doesn't force us to follow him. Jesus Christ, through his love, he gave us a reason to follow him. And he's saying this is how husbands act in their lives with their love for their wives. And he compares the wife to the church. And when he compares the wife to the church, there's actually about the best comparison you can give when you think about it. Because throughout the course of human history, there's not been any greater love that has ever been shown than the love that Christ showed for the church. And in the way that he died, the way that he was crucified, the way that he had nails driven through his arms for the church. The way that he leads the church is because he sacrificed himself for them. And the church knows and follows Christ because we know that he has our best interests at heart. And he's saying this greatest love that you've ever seen is the type of love that a husband should have for his wife. And the type of love it is the agape love. We've heard that word. Agape is the Greek. We just have one word for love. And the Greeks, they had multiple words for love and different kinds of love. And agape love is that love that's self-sacrificial, that sacrifices itself, that seeks to give and doesn't expect a return on it. And he's saying that husbands, this is the type of way that you love your wives. Which is interesting because he doesn't use the word eros. Eros was another word for love. Eros is the type of romantic love that lovers have. It's a type of love. Eros is a type of love that should also exist and has a healthy place within the marriage relationship as well. But that's just not the word that Paul uses. Eros is the type of word that many philosophers of his day would have used to talk about the relationship between a man and a wife. But even the Greek philosophers of the day, as we do, they knew that eros, that romantic love, that warm, cuddly feeling, it is a little bit fleeting. It doesn't always stay. Whereas agape is something that it gives without regard to merit. Agape love acts even when you don't feel like acting. Eros as well. Eros is this romantic feeling. It also seeks some type of pleasure out of a relationship, which isn't bad within a marriage relationship, but it seeks some type of pleasure. It seeks what I'm able to get out of it as well. And agape is just the opposite. It doesn't think about what it's going to get in return. It thinks about what I can give, what I can put into this. This is what Paul is saying. The type of love of the husband for his wife should look like. As we get back to leadership, he doesn't use the word leadership, but there's a certain leadership that comes from love. He talks about husbands that They love their own bodies. Husbands love their flesh. I mean, people love themselves. We know how to feed ourselves. We know how to entertain ourselves. We spend time. I mean, even when we think that we don't love ourselves and we can struggle with sadness or other things like that, we still have our minds focused on how we're feeling in that situation. And Paul's saying that if you know how to entertain yourself, you know how to treat your own body well, you know how to feed yourself. Well, now when you're married, you're one flesh with your wife. And if you can't think, if you can't help, if all of a sudden you've forgotten how to take care of your own flesh or how to love your own flesh, well, forget about marrying if you haven't. Because that's not the type of love that you're supposed to, because the type of love that you're supposed to exhibit in marriage is the same type of love that you have for yourself, and even greater than that, even giving of your own self and your own needs for your wives. And that's ultimately the leadership that we see through love. It's the leadership that we see Christ having as well. And he never forced us to follow him, but we follow him because of all the sacrifices that he made for us. And if you can imagine within a marriage, if this is how husbands behaved, if this is how husbands acted, where every single thought was on the needs of their wife, and every single thought was, I need to do this in the best interest of my wife, and this decision has her best interest at heart, every single time, even if it means sacrificing our needs or our own desires to make those decisions for the best interest of our spouses. You can imagine that in a world like that, in a marriage like that, I don't think that it would be that difficult for the wife to say, I trust my husband to make the best decision, and I trust him with the directions that he's going. Both of these things, these commands for the wife to submit to the husband and for the husband to love his wife, they're given without qualification. It's something, if we're going to be pleasing to God, we do it because we're serving the Lord. Even when we're in marriages that aren't good, that are bad, and we don't follow this through till it leads us to sin as well. But wives submit to their husbands even when the husbands aren't faithful. And husbands love their wives, even in ways in which when the wife might not be behaving the best. And we do it because ultimately, at the end of the day, marriage is something that points to something greater. It points to the love that Christ had for the church, and it points to the devotion the church has for Christ. Going back to Plato's analogy of the cave, the allegory, marriage is really the shadow of the real substance. Marriage is the thing that we see on the cave wall, and it's reflection of what's going on and how much Christ loves us and how much Christ cared for us and how much Christ has sacrificed for us. And our marriages should be like that. They should be an example to the world, an insight into what that sun, what that light ultimately looks like. Christ calls us to love because he first loved us. And if you're standing outside of Christ's love, it's not because Christ doesn't love you, but it's because you haven't embraced him on your own terms. You haven't embraced him yourself. If there's needs that you have, if there's sin in your life, if you need to turn your life around, or if you need to come to him for the first time in baptism and repentance to be forgiven of your sins, now's the time to do so. Please come forward as we stand in sin.